When Gary woke up in a Floyd County jail cell on the morning of August 13, 1974, he was told that he had shot and killed his common-law wife the night before. He had no memory of what had happened or how he'd gotten into that jail cell, and no idea why he would have done a thing like shoot Grace. It wasn't until 6 days later, at the preliminary hearing before the Floyd County Superior Court, that he found out the circumstances of her death. Grace's 15-year-old daughter, Beverly, testified that she'd been in her bed, in her back porch off the kitchen that had been converted into a bedroom floor, and she'd been listening to records when she heard a gunshot and leapt out of bed, went to the doorway at the kitchen, and she'd watched in silence as her stepfather Gary shot Grace several more times before he'd turned and walked out of the kitchen, flipping off the lights on his way out. Gary's always known that Beverly's story can't be true. He had that much to hold on to, even after his conviction. He couldn't remember killing Grace, and he couldn't remember not killing Grace, so he couldn't say for sure if he was guilty or not. But casually gunning her down in the kitchen, either for no reason at all, or maybe because he'd asked her to make some dinner and she'd said she was tired, that was too absurd, too impossible. Whatever happened that night, it wasn't that. Years later, while in prison for Grace's murder, his memories of that night did start to return. He started to recall what had really happened, who had really shot her. So between Gary and Beverly, we have two accounts of Grace's murder. And you'd think that'd make it easy, or easier, to puzzle out what had really happened in the house that night. Because even if one of them's lying to cover up a crime, that would still leave us with the other one to tell us what really happened, right? At least one of them ought to be able to tell us, or ought to be able to explain how she was killed in a straightforward, consistent way. That's not how things worked out. Yes, Gary and Beverly can both tell us who it is they remember killing Grace that night, but I'm not sure either of them gets us closer to understanding who's responsible for Grace's murder. We don't know what Beverly's first story was, what it was she'd said that night after her mom was killed and she was talking to the cops. But looking over all the things she said over the years, we can piece together kind of a general outline. We know that after the murder, after Grace had been shot and left lying on the floor of that kitchen, Beverly had left her bedroom and ran through the kitchen to the living room, where she found her 17-year-old sister, Charlotte. At the trial, Beverly never said which of the two of them it was that actually called the police that night, but she testified that she stayed in the house after the murder until the police arrived. And Charlotte said the same thing, that Beverly had come into the living room after Gary left and that she'd told her sister to go call the police. So Beverly had gone into the bedroom and called the police from the phone there. And maybe that's what happened, but that does seem to be the last time that either Charlotte or Beverly had told this version of events. Because Charlotte and Beverly both agree now that Beverly left the house that night. After the murder, she just took off running, out the front door and down the street. And Beverly says now that she ran to call the police. She was scared the shooter would turn and shoot her too. She wanted out of there. So she ran next door and knocked on the door till the lady came into the door and went inside and called 911. Or tried to.
All I remember is one of them beating on that door and that old lady coming through the door, and I told her that my mama got shot. I remember I didn't know the police number and I dialed the operator.
We don't have the police file in Gary's case, so we don't know much about what happened when the police arrived there on Maple Street that night. They were there within a couple minutes, and according to the cops, both the girls, both Beverly and Charlotte, were out in the front yard waiting for them when they arrived. Carol Gresham and her husband own the house where Grace and Gary were living, and Carol lives in that same house today with her son and his family. I'd wanted to see the inside of it to get a better feel for the layout and what the witnesses were describing, just to see how everything was set up. So one day, Gary and I stopped by, and while there, Carol mentioned that she'd actually been at the house the night of the murder. Well, after the murder. Not too long after. She couldn't recall too much now, but What still stands out in her mind, even today, is what she'd seen as she'd pulled up that night. An image of two girls sitting calmly together on a porch swing.
But you knew that Grace had been killed when you arrived?
There'd been a shooting in this house. I don't know if it was the police called or who, but the police was asking questions. But see, I didn't know nothing because I wasn't here.
But when you got up, you drove up and you saw the girls on the porch?
Yeah, I thought that was weird. They're sitting out there swinging. They had blonde hair, you wouldn't know nothing happened, I guess. They were just sitting there swinging.
Contrary.
But now that might have been after.
That actually matches what Beverly told me.
Beverly and Charlotte remained at the crime scene for a while with the cops, but later in the early morning hours, after their mom had been taken away, both of them were taken to the police station to give statements. When I talked to Beverly, she told me that she'd been confused and frustrated by what Charlotte was saying that night and what she was telling her, because at first the police were questioning them together, but they started to argue. Beverly told me that Charlotte had told her that what she was saying wasn't true, that what she was saying wasn't how it happened, and Beverly was upset by this. How can Charlotte tell me that's not what I saw? Because that's what I saw. Beverly said that as a result of the girls arguing, one of the police officers, Officer Kynes, had instructed the other officers to take Charlotte and question her somewhere else, and he'd question Beverly by himself. But without that police file, we don't know what Beverly or Charlotte ultimately said, or what it was they're disagreeing about. Which means that Beverly's testimony at the preliminary hearing, a week after the murder, is the first record we have of what Grace's daughter said happened on the night their mother was killed. But Beverly's testimony in that hearing was roughly the same outline as what she said at trial and what she sometimes says even after the trial was over. About how she'd been laying in her bed in that back porch bedroom when her mother and Gary walked into the kitchen just a few feet away from her on the other side of the kitchen wall. Gary was saying something about how he wanted to go down to the Waffle House to get something to eat, and Grace said no, he shouldn't, he'd get a DUI. Grace just reached over to turn on the eye of the stove to light a cigarette when Beverly heard her say, "I knew the day would come." Gary responded, "It is here." And then a shot rang out. Beverly sprung out of bed and ran to the door, and when she got there, Grace was still standing. But then Gary shot four more times and she fell. Then Gary turned off that kitchen light and walked out. Neither Gary nor Grace had seen her during the shooting, Beverly said. And also, she'd been the only one there, the only one to witness the shooting. Charlotte had been on the other side of the house, and Beverly never saw her until after Gary had left. This basic sequence would be what Charlotte and Beverly testified to at Gary's trial. Most of the details do get changed in Beverly's version, moved around, altered a bit, but the outline still roughly matches up. Gary shot her mother. She saw it with her own eyes. It wasn't until after the trial that Beverly changed her mind. Said she'd lied, that she'd never seen Gary kill her mother, and that she didn't believe he'd done it. But if Beverly lied at Gary's trial, why? What reasons could she have had?
Stamps.com brings all the services of the U.S. Postal Service right to your fingertips. You can buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter, any package, any class of mail using just your own computer and printer. Stamps.com makes it easy. They'll send you a digital scale that automatically calculates exact postage. Stamps.com will even help you decide the best class of mail based on your needs. You can create your Stamps.com account in minutes online with no equipment to lease and no long-term commitments. You just click, print, mail, and you're done. And unlike the post office, Stamps.com never closes. You can print postage for letters or packages at your convenience 24/7. Now, I'll say that on Undisclosed, we have several different arcs coming up on different cases from different states, and Stamps.com has made life so easy in terms of getting and receiving documents related to those cases. And right now, you too can enjoy Stamps.com with a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus postage in a digital scale without long-term commitments. Just go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in undisclosed. That's stamps.com, enter undisclosed. Stamps.com. Never go to the post office again.
From the stories I've heard about Beverly, and later from talking to Beverly herself, the picture I've built up in my head of what Beverly was like back then, at 15 years old, is almost a tragic take on Anne of Green Gables. She was chatty and friendly and guileless and easy to underestimate. No, she doesn't have red hair, but she did lament to me about how she'd always been tow-headed, in contrast to her mother's beautiful jet-black hair. And she had a tendency to come up with these impossibly dramatic stories, impossible to believe, and leaving you uncertain if you were supposed to believe them, or if you were supposed to know that she was just telling a story. But unlike Anne of Green Gables, Beverly didn't start off an orphan. She became one at 15, and her attempts thereafter to find a home again took her to all the wrong places. Gary didn't even meet any of Grace's kids until after he'd been dating Grace for a while. Actually, Gary didn't even know Grace had kids until after he'd been dating her for a while. It wasn't until months later, after they'd opened up their first beer joint and were living together, that he learned that Grace had three daughters. Decades later, in the mid-90s, Beverly would call him up sometimes to talk about the case, and one time they ended up getting off topic and started talking about other memories instead, about happier times. And Gary told Beverly about the first time he'd ever met her and her sisters.
Y'all came down. Grace and I had the tavern. I didn't know Grace had kids. And one day, Yvonne and them drove up, unloaded you and Charlotte and Debbie.
Didn't y'all live in a trailer down there?
Yeah.
I remember that.
And you just start talking like we had known each other all our lives. You did.
I can't remember all that.
You started talking like we had known each other all our lives.
I remember we stayed in the trailer down there and you had an old Buick or something. Do you remember that?
I gave that to Fred Isabel. I won a car in a poker game.
I remember that car.
And I gave it. It was a convertible.
I asked Gary about what it had been like to suddenly learn that his girlfriend had three kids that she'd never mentioned before, and to have them dropped off on his doorstep out of the blue and be told, oh, by the way, they're going to be living with you now.
And I thought, now, man, I'm in a mess. But we did the best we could do, came in, and at that time, I remember how old they were. She had one child by doorway, and that was Debbie. Of course, Debbie was just a little, she was a baby herself, just a little thing. And she still didn't stay with us much, but the Beverly and Charlotte ended up there. So now we got Beverly and Charlotte there, and we got the beer joint there, and then they, of course, want to hang out in the beer joint during the daytime. I didn't really like that because I didn't remember where I come up at. I just didn't think it was a good thing to do.
But despite the surprise, Gary had been fond of Beverly.
But of the two, Beverly had the best personality. You didn't mind being around her. I mean, she had a good personality. She laugh and carry on.
She was cheerful and always willing to help out.
I'm telling you, Beverly was a likable person. She was a likable kid, and you could enjoy being around Beverly. And she was, I hate to say this, but I guess she would have been my favorite. But, yeah, Beverly did. She would pitch in and help, and she'd clean the house and do stuff. And she could be a lot of fun. I wish things had...
Gary had been less fond of Grace's eldest daughter, Charlotte. They just hadn't gotten along as well. And from Beverly's descriptions of Charlotte, you can kind of see why a little.
You were always getting in trouble because of something.
When we lived in East Point, and Charlotte wouldn't do dishes. I would have to do dishes. shot would go down to the park and meet boys, and I would end up cleaning the kitchen and sitting at the same lunch instead of Charlotte getting a whipping. I would get a whipping, and I never understood that.
Do you remember when y'all got caught for shoplifting?
Yeah.
And I had to come get you both out of jail?
You know, I was innocent.
Yeah, I knew that.
Greg was guilty.
I had to come get you both out of jail.
So the children were probably the primary source of conflict between Grace and Gary, especially with her letting the girls hang out at the beer joint with them during the day. That's part of why, after Grace and Gary had their son, and after Grace had left Gary in Atlanta to go back to Rome, Gary had obtained full custody.
The only way you can keep him is to adopt him and get her to waiver her right as a parent. So she could only see him if I let her see him. And she didn't have a problem with that at the time.
And since Gary had adopted his son, he was able to make sure that he was taken care of consistently. But as for Grace's girls, well, at the times that they were all living together, that was a topic that Grace and Gary had disagreed over. Much as had been the case for Gary, Grace's girls never had much of a chance to have a childhood.
I really thought Beverly might be able to pull through it and make it. But then she gets hooked up with this...
Minshew?
Oh, God, man. That was awful. So most of our battles was about that.
Beverly did have aunts and uncles, and after her mother's death, she stayed with them from time to time. They'd try to care for her, but she hadn't always been easy to deal with. And Gary had been the closest thing to a father that Beverly had ever had, and his imprisonment had felt like an abandonment of her. She once tried to explain to Gary the rage she'd felt towards him as a teenager when she'd suddenly been left parentless with her mother dead and her father locked up for killing her mother.
Do you know how I hated you? Do you know what you took away from me? You were the only man in my life that ever was a daddy to me. Doyle Wade was never a daddy to me, and I don't even remember who was before him. I was 8 years old when she got with you. I was 15 when she died. And you were the only man that ever took care of us when we was with Mama. You were the only one that cared if we had a home when we was with Mama.
If Beverly lied at Gary's trial, then whatever it was that motivated her to do so, I don't think it could have been because she had any kind of personal vendetta against Gary. Gary was one of the few stable adults in her life, and from the way she described it, living in that house on Maple Street may have been just about one of the happiest times in her whole life. For a few months, when they were all living there, they'd been a family. With a beautiful house that was full of beautiful new furniture and shining hardwood floors in the living room and lovely golden carpet in the bedrooms, Gary had even ordered a canopy bed for her, though it was really only a four-poster bed when Beverly had it. They'd had to order the canopy part separately, but Beverly never got the canopy. Her mother had been murdered before it arrived, and she never went back into the house.
I started drinking. I started smoking pot. I started doing drugs. You know why? Because I didn't have nothing to live for. It's not because I killed my mama that I smoked pot and done drugs and drank.
Yeah.
It's because I didn't have nobody. Because my life has been fucked up all my life. And I don't think it's fair. And I don't think it's fair that your life has been either.
Two months after his conviction, Gary was still in Floyd County Jail, awaiting the Georgia Department of Corrections picking him up and taking him into their system. That's when Beverly recanted for the first time.
So one day, Beverly comes to my parents' house. She was crying. She says, I lied at the trial. So they call my sister. My sister comes over. Well, they didn't know what to do. So they contact where I was at the jail. They contact the sheriff. His name was Lynn Garner. Lynn Garner was a good man. He really tried to help me. He was elected, and he was really after Scoggins because he knew Scoggins was involved in two murders himself. Plus, he was on the tape. So he was wider come to town going to clean up this corrupt county.
Gary's parents had taken Beverly to the sheriff's department because they had nowhere else to go. Gary's appellate attorney was the same attorney who'd represented him at trial, Bill Buffington. And he was just a few months shy of drinking himself to death. There was no point in going to him. So they went to the jail because that's where Gary was and that's what they knew. And in doing so, they walked right into the middle of a Floyd County political battle.
Lynn Garner was the first Republican ever elected here.
Oh.
Okay.
So that's why he was so
popular. The first Republican. And that's, and let me tell you, the Democrats were just up in arms about it. I mean, that flew all over them and the Scoggins people. And he was the anti-candidate, okay? I mean, he ran against the system. He was very open and hostile about it. And Lynn had an attitude. If he was your friend, he was your friend. But, boy, if he was your enemy, you better watch out.
Yeah, so I guess the fact that Beverly talked to him and gave the first statement changing our story, that meant from then on the Democrat side was going to be opposed to him.
That's right.
That was Bob Fennell. Back in 1977, when he'd only been out of law school for a couple years, he'd represented Gary in one of his post-conviction proceedings. He'd known Lynn Garner and thought well of him, but not everyone in Floyd County had nice things to say about the sheriff.
Some of them put it in much more harsher terms, calling him, like, stubborn and irrational. But I think that's
He could be that way. Lynn could be that way. Mm-hmm. But, once he thought he was right about something, watch out. Lynn had a strong sense of right and wrong and just and unjust. And once he had found his just, he wasn't going to let go.
And after speaking to Charlotte and Beverly, Sheriff Garner became convinced of Gary's innocence. Beverly came down to the jail and spoke to Garner that first time in April of 75. And that same night, she went over to speak to Gary at the jail, and then to Gary's sister and his parents. Bea Purdy, Gary's sister, wrote an affidavit recounting everything Beverly had said to them in the jail that day. And then, one night 20 years later, Beverly called Gary to talk, and he read the affidavit to her, hoping she'd explain why she'd said the things she'd said.
Well, let me read to you what happened at the Floyd County Jail on April 8, 1975 at approximately 3 p.m. Beverly Reynolds made the following statement in my presence. The location of when the statement was made was at the Floyd County Jail. She had met with Sheriff Lynn Garner to make a statement. After meeting with him, Beverly Reynolds then met with Gary Reeves. This is a list of the people that were there. Mrs. Marie Reeves, Mr. Herschel Reeves, Mrs. L.M. Purdy. And this is the statement which she made in our presence within 15 minutes after meeting with Sheriff Lynn Garner. Beverly Reynolds said, "Gary, you did not shoot Mama. You were at the sink with your back to Mama. You had a glass of ice fixing to pour a drink. A shot was fired. Mama was trying to defend you and was shot in the hand. You turned around when you heard the shot, reached in your holster for your gun, tried to aim it, but was shaken so. You looked at Mama and put your gun back in the holster, threw up your hands, picked up Sean, and left the house." Beverly also said there were others in the house, but the one who was to be killed was Gary. She said her mama got in the way. She also said mama had on pink pajamas, which had been changed to blue robe, which was Charlotte Reynolds. She said the undertaker told them her mama's clothes had been changed because the blood had been smeared on her body. In her statement, she said there was footprints, big ones, which had tracked in mama's blood. She said both salmon had been hit on the head and knocked unconscious. This is on record at the city police department. She said both salmon was picked up. He had been hit 3 times on the head. She also said this is the statement you made then.
Amen.
Both salmon. She also said that her mother's grave was visited on Easter Sunday and someone had tried to dig it up. She asked Gary as soon as possible as she entered the room when we met at the Floyd County Jail to forgive her. And she was sorry she told the lie on the witness stand against him.
I did come see you.
And you did ask me to forgive you. He said she was forgiven. She said, Gary, you're the only father I ever had. She said the reason she lied because she was mad at him. She said Richard Holcomb had the gun that killed her mother. And Doyle Wade's name was used freely in my presence. That was hidden in the archives of some stuff we had came across a few days ago. But I remember you coming to the jail, and I remember you asking me to forgive you.
Do you remember me coming to the jail in the pink maxi?
Yeah. And you asked me to forgive you, and I said I did, and you said I was there. Yeah. And you said I was the only father that you ever had. And that's what I tried to be to you.
And I lost you and her both.
Yeah.
There is so much going on in the statement. Grace had been protecting Gary when she died. Gary had been the one to be killed. Richard Holcomb had the gun. Doyle Wade's name was being used all over the place. Unfortunately, Beverly wasn't willing or wasn't able to elaborate on any of it. When Gary asked about it during his phone call in the 90s, she remembered the event happening. She remembered going to the jail and seeing Gary and wearing that pink maxi dress. But the rest of it, she seems ambivalent towards, neither confirming nor denying. She does object at one point, saying that the part about the footprints in the hall or in the carpet, that's what Charlotte said, not her. She tried to correct Gary on that point. But according to the affidavit from Gary's sister, that's what Beverly had said, at least on that day. And Gary's sister didn't talk to Charlotte. At some point, after Beverly had made the statement in the jail, Sheriff Garner decided to get a tape statement from Beverly. This time, though, she walked her story back a little, saying only that she'd never seen Gary fire his gun that night.
When I heard that first shot, the record player was cutting off itself. I jumped up and I ran over to the door. I glanced at Mama. I glanced back at Gary. His hand was straight, but the shots kept firing. I don't know if they were firing from Gary's gun, and I never did see nobody else.
You never did see any fire come out of his gun?
No, sir.
You never did see
his gun was still. His hand and the gun were straight, and they stayed that way.
Way to custom frame your favorite art and photos without ever leaving your house is FrameBridge. With your simple online ordering process, you can order a fully customized piece in minutes. And here's how it works. You upload your photo from your computer or directly from your Instagram feed, or if you have a physical item, they'll provide secure prepaid packaging so you can mail it into them for free. You can preview your photo online in any frame style, choose your favorite, or get free help from their talented designers. The expert team at FrameBridge will custom frame your item in days, not weeks or months, and deliver your finished piece directly to your door, ready to hang. The best part? Instead of the hundreds you'd pay at a framing store, their prices start at $39, and all shipping is free. Plus, our listeners will get 15% off their first order at framebridge.com/undisclosed. FrameBridge even offers a happiness guarantee. If for any reason you aren't 100% satisfied with your order, they will make it right. Now, I gave FrameBridge a try for myself, and I had them frame some pieces that were very special to me. Two pieces of handmade truck art that I brought over from Pakistan. This is a very unique style of art that's pretty much only found in Pakistan. It adorns the sides of trucks all over the country. It's gorgeous, it's colorful, but it's not easy to frame. And they did a beautiful job and delivered it back to me. And you can check out what I got framed and see the story behind it by visiting framebridge.com/undisclosed. And you'll also see what Colin got framed, by the way. We love the way our pieces turned out, and we hope you guys do too. So get started today framing your photos or art. Go to framebridge.com/undisclosed. To see what we framed and to save an additional 15% off your first order. This was the first time I used FrameBridge, but it will definitely not be the last. And by the way, I would love to see the art and pictures that you guys get framed, so tweet them at me. Now just go to framebridge.com/undisclosed and remember, you will get 15% off your first order. framebridge.com/undisclosed.
Beverly kept making statements and kept contradicting earlier statements, and finally she was brought in so that attorneys could question her. The prosecutor at Gary's trial, Englehart, and Gary's new defense attorney, Jer White, were both there. And Beverly did tell them kind of the same thing about never seeing Gary fire his gun, about his gun always being still, and there never being recoil or muzzle flash or movement from the gun, but she didn't stop there. Suddenly, all kinds of new details appear in Beverly's story. For instance, Beverly now claimed that although 6 shots had been fired and all that night, the first shot had happened quite a long time before the last 5 shots were fired.
Can you now say it was how long between the first shot and the other 5?
10 minutes before I got to the door.
You mean it was 10? You mean it was that long, honey?
Yeah.
Now 10 minutes is a. Now I'm not trying.
It's a long time.
I'm not trying to back you up, but I mean, from the time that you heard the first shot until the other 5, there was 10 minutes that elapsed.
I laid on that bed from 5 to 10 minutes before I got it to the door.
Why did you wait so long?
I don't know. I was scared.
And then when you got to the door, that's when Gary was standing there with his pistol and you and the other 5 shots were fired.
Yes, sir.
And they just right behind each other?
Those were just right behind each other.
In just a few seconds then.
Yes, sir.
And Beverly told the attorneys that after talking things over with Charlotte, she'd started to realize that she'd made a mistake.
Why did you come in at a later date and say that this didn't happen just exactly like you told it in court? I mean, there's some reason there. I mean,
because I don't feel Gary done it after I sent and talked with my sister, because she could swear up and down that Doorway had done it.
Uh-huh. Well, now, how did Charlotte how did she see Doorway?
She said he was here in the bedroom and run out.
She said that he was hid in the bedroom and ran out after?
And ran out before Mama was killed.
Ran out what?
Before Mama was killed. He ran out of the bedroom into the dining room.
What was he doing in her bedroom?
I don't know. It's just a mixed up situation, man.
According to Beverly, Charlotte told her that Doyle Wade had been hiding in their mother's bedroom, that he'd run out before she'd been murdered. Beverly doesn't know why. According to her, it was just a mixed-up situation, really. And I can't tell what Beverly was trying to say here, and I don't think the attorneys interviewing her could quite figure it out either. Though they were clearly trying to puzzle out what kind of meaning was behind the details she was giving them.
All right, now why would Doyle Wade do it?
Because he had been trying to get back to her for living with Gary when they first separated.
Had they had problems?
He had asked her at the place to go back to him, and she said no. He said, well, I'll get back at you. She said, Doyle, you're crazy.
Beverly never says that she saw Doyle Wade in the house that night. She is very clear in saying that it was Charlotte who saw Doyle Wade. But then Beverly adds, there was something she'd seen that night in the house that she'd failed to mention when she testified at trial. Gary and Grace weren't the only figures she'd seen in the kitchen that night.
Well, how do you know he was there?
Well, like I told you, Charlotte said he was, and when it was all happening in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
Well, from the point I was standing, I couldn't have seen him from where she said he was. But from Gary to Mama, there was a shadow.
There was another shadow from Gary to your mother.
A shadow. Beverly says there was also a shadow in the kitchen with Grace and Gary when her mother was shot. But at this point, it seems like the attorneys had just lost patience and they did not press Beverly to explain what she meant by this, by what she was describing when she says she saw a shadow in the kitchen.
But lay the cards on the table, for God's sakes, don't play with us, because this is a serious matter. You have a man that is at Reedsville now serving a life sentence.
Could be innocent.
What?
Could be innocent. He could be innocent.
That's what I'm saying. He could be. I don't know. I was not there. Mr. Englehart was not there. The judge, the jurors were not there. They depended upon you and Charlotte to tell them the truth.
Talking to Beverly alone was not getting them much of anywhere. So the attorneys brought in Beverly and Charlotte together to question them about why their stories weren't matching up and why Beverly's story kept changing. Charlotte denied that she'd seen Doyle Wade in the house that night, or that she'd told Beverly that she'd seen Doyle Wade. And finally, in the closing seconds of the interview, the attorneys get Beverly to change her story about Doyle Wade and about how, well, he hadn't been seen in the house that night before her mother was shot.
Well, now, Beverly, you just said positive that she told you she saw it. Do you change that now?
Yeah, because she said she didn't.
And yeah, that tape stopping and starting again, that's how the original cassette is. It makes you wonder what it was Beverly said the first time that caused them to go back and make her answer it again. But Beverly's original recantation to Sheriff Garner marked a big change for Gary, too. The very next day, he was shipped out of Floyd County and processed into the Georgia prison system.
And the battle between Sheriff Garner and the court, it was a battle. They got me the next day. They came and got me, sent me to Jackson. And I went through the diagnostic center at Jackson. And guy asked me, he said, what did you do outside? And I said, well, I ran a package store in Atlanta. And I was in the tavern business. He said, we don't have any openings for bartenders and liquor store runners. I said, we're going to send you to Reidsville.
Reidsville is Georgia's most notorious prison. Violent, dehumanizing, and overcrowded. And in 1978, it came under federal oversight because too many people had been killed there, and the rest were warehoused in abysmal conditions.
And Reidsville was hell. It was hell on earth. First day I got there, I saw a man die.
When he got shipped off to Reidsville, he was in a bus with another man from Floyd County who gave him some advice on how to survive what lay ahead.
This guy named Hudon Smith, and I'm going to show you that paper in a minute. He's the one who told about Scoggins.
Hudon Smith had testified in the corruption and vice investigation back in 1970. He was the one who'd saved all the receipts of the bribes he'd been paying Judge Scoggins. Well, in 1972, he ended up getting charged in a convoluted robbery scheme, and Judge Scoggins had presided over it. Despite the fact that Hudon Smith was someone who had a very pressing personal conflict with him. Anyway, Hudon Smith got convicted, so he was back in Floyd County, trying to get a new trial, trying to argue his sentence should be overturned because Judge Scoggins should not have overseen a trial for him. And that's when he met Gary.
And he told me we were on the same bus going from Jackson back. He'd been up here to county jail trying to get a new trial, too. He said, don't buddy up with anybody. He may be a good old boy, but if he's got enemies, they're going to become your enemies. So what you had to do is you had to keep to yourself, but you couldn't act like you was better than somebody else, you know?
Ed Reidsville, keeping to yourself can only refer to having a certain state of mind. Physically, it's just not possible.
Reidsville was bad. It was bad. I ended up in a dormitory that was built for 50 men, maybe, and there was over 100 in there. So we get into the dormitory, and this guy named Tootie, called him Tootie, and another named Ironhead. He'd been shot in the head with a .357 Magnum and lived and had an iron plate in his head. They were the house men. You know, they ran the dormitory. So he called us over there, and he had this whistle around his neck. He said, if you guys like to fight, so go ahead and call them now and get you another dormitory. I said, brother, I don't want to fight nobody. I just want to go. Whatever I got to do to get through this thing.
Gary had been sentenced to life at hard labor, and that's what Reidsville offered.
So I ended up out on a detail digging stumps out the swamp. So they cut these trees down, and you go out there and dig them up. Now, I've been in jail since back in August, and here I am. I never done any labor like this anyway. So here I am now on a detail. And you line up in the mornings. You had a number, and they call you number. And you was a number. And you say, check it. And then they put you between the fences. And then they'd count you again. And then you'd get on this bus with no seats. And you were standing on the bus, nose to nose, hot weather, taken out to the fields or whatever you were going to work that day. And you worked. Then at lunchtime, they put you back on the bus they carried you back to industrial mess hall, and they had this stew called hoghead stew. And they had the whole hog's head in it. It was bad. Yeah, it was terrible. There was a houseman job coming open. I wanted that job because what was bad was the noise. The noise was so bad. And once you got 100-something men in a dormitory built for 50, and you got all this noise, and you got a TV on each end, only the houseman could change the TV station, and it had to be voted to where you changed it at. But all that noise was just god-awful. And that houseman job, once those details went out, man, quiet. Yeah. And see, I still got no memory of nothing. I got my family back home trying to get something done, trying to get another attorney, working on it, and they would send me letters, and that mail call was, man, you'd live for that. Because then they didn't have phones. You had to apply to the counselor to make a phone call once a month. You have 5 minutes.
This life of chain gangs and noise and hogshead stew, that should have been Gary's life for at least half a decade, minimum.
In Reeseville, I was supposed to be there 5 years before I was eligible for a transfer. I'd been there a year. I had the houseman job. I get a letter from my sister, and she says, by faith, apply for a transfer. And I said, I can't transfer out of here for 5 years. But by faith, do it. Okay. Act of faith. I'll try that. I applied for a transfer. Bam. Denied. So one day they bring an old boy in from Rome, Georgia, and his name was Jimmy Gravely, and he was a piano player. He played gospel music at churches and places, but he'd gotten involved with a girl who was underage. I don't know if he knew she was underage or what, but anyway, there he was, and this guy was scared to death. Now, it was bad for me, but I'd run these beer joints, and I'm used to rough and tumble and people shooting people and fights and cuts and all that kind of stuff. I've lived in it all my life. This old boy played piano for a living, and here he is. He's scared to death. So I kind of just took him under the wing, and I just said, okay, here's how you do this. When you walk to the mess hall, you stay on the line, you stay against the wall. I don't care what you see. If you see a guy cutting a guy's throat, you put your head against the wall and you walk on by. You don't see nothing. And so it kind of protected him from that. So anyway, he got transferred. He was gone. And he was at Carroll County. So I didn't know this was happening. But for helping him, and he went to Carroll County, and he became the warden secretary at Carroll County. Now, Carroll County was a old-timey chain gang. Have you ever seen Cool Hand Luke, movie Cool Hand Luke, Paul Newman, road gang, they worked on the road, all that stuff. Well, that was Carroll County. And so what was going on, Jimmy was sending, I put in for another transfer. That's faith, do it again. Okay. So Jimmy was, he was a warden secretary. And he was sending a letter. The only way you could transfer before 5 years was if a warden requested you. I didn't know any wardens. So I didn't know one was requesting me either. And he didn't know it either. Jimmy was requesting it. And so one day, last time I put in for a transfer, man, I get a notice. You're shipping out of here tomorrow. I never did really unpack, to tell you the truth. I kept a bag pretty well packed. But that night, and because I'd seen this before, people could be jealous. And if they knew you're about to leave, they could cause some trouble for you. And you know, I stayed awake all night. I lay there all night long looking at that ceiling, watching everything around me. and I got out of there, and I didn't look back.
In 2017, there's way too much going on for one person to keep up with. That's why you need the Skim. They give you all the important news and information you need to start your day in 5 minutes or less. The Skim stores up the news right when you need it in one simple email every single morning with style and no BS. It's fun, informative, and it's free. The Skim covers politics, world events, sports, and entertainment. I can learn about new Supreme Court opinions and new TV shows that are premiering. And now you can too. Sign up today at theskim.com/undisclosed and you'll be entered to win a $250 Visa gift card. This isn't a free trial. The Skim is always free every day. There's nothing to pay and only knowledge to gain. So that's theskim.com/undisclosed. The Skim, spelled with two M's, spelled the SKIMM.com/undisclosed. And again, you can sign up right now for the Skim, enter for your chance to win a $250 Visa gift card at theskim.com/undisclosed.
So, Gary was off to Carroll County. It's not that Carroll County was perfect, but just about anywhere on Earth was better than Reidsville.
They put me on that Bluebird bus, got to Carroll County, came in through the back door. Well, the kitchen was back there. And they brought me in. Jimmy had, unbeknownst to me, requested that I be transferred there to work in the kitchen. Well, the kitchen people lived downstairs in a little small area. They were there was eight people in that little closet, bunk beds. One of them was what they call a dog boy. The reason the kitchen people lived down there is because they had to get up 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning and start preparing these lunches for the gangs to go out and take their lunch with. So that was where they were going to put me. Well, this dog boy, and that sounds bad.
It's a dog
boy. Yeah, you can explain that one.
You know what that is?
No.
Oh, okay. He's a prisoner who, if someone escapes, he goes with the guards and he takes care of the dogs and trains the dogs to find tracks. So he is an unpopular person. The kitchen people lived down there because they had to get up early. We couldn't live in population. And Jimmy lived down there because he was the secretary to the warden. But the dog boy had lived down there because they'd killed him upstairs. So I didn't know nobody except Jimmy. So they bring me through the back door, and the main cook, his name was Howard Miller. He looked out and he said, "I don't like that SOB already." I mean, they didn't even know me, man. So I come through, and I never will forget this. Like, we came through the back kitchen and the door, and there's a little breezeway right here. Well, here's the dog boy with an axe handle, and I walk through, and he swings at me, and I duck. The guy tried to knock my head off when I come through. Reason was, he knew I was coming out of Reidsville, notorious prison. He's thinking that I would probably try to kill him because he was a dog boy and he's just going to get me first.
That dog boy wasn't being paranoid, just realistic. An article I found in the Rome News Tribune from a year after Gary's conviction showed just how real the danger was. It said, John D. Whitey Bailey was the dog boy during his 15 years in prison for the slaying of his wife. His job was to handle the bloodhounds, which tracked those who tried to escape. "If certain people ever get out of prison, I'm dead," he remarked to authorities. He never mentioned names, and Mitchell County officials wish now that he'd been more specific. Bailey, 68, is dead, run down in his yard by some type of vehicle, and then repeatedly run over with his own pickup truck. But despite the dog boy's attempt to murder him within 5 seconds of getting in the prison, all in all, Carroll County was pretty great.
There you had mustard and ketchup and salt and pepper on the table, and man, I hadn't seen that in a while. You know, it was a chain gang, but compared to Reidsville, it was like a resort.
And it was there at Carroll County that Gary's memories of the night Grace died first started to come back to him.
I'm laying out there enjoying the world, the clouds. And my mind began to open up. I began to, wait a minute, I went here that day. I went to the Pontiac place that day. Now, they accused me of, when we tried to get another trial, they accused me of, the lawyer's word, the attorney was, well, his memory just miraculously recovered. Well, it wasn't that way. It recovered slowly, but I began to remember different things.
Gary's last clear memory of the night of Grace's murder is leaving the beer joint to pick up his son. From there, he says he went back to the house, and when he got there, Richard Holcomb was there, and others were out on the porch as well. So he put Sean down, and Sean ran inside, and then he sat down on the porch just to have a drink and shoot the breeze before bed. Nothing had really happened until after a while, after talking to Richard for a bit in the porch, he was called inside by Charlotte. Here's how Gary told me the story the first time I met him.
Basically what happened, I can remember Charlotte coming to the door and telling me I had a phone call. And it was a woman. If that woman is still living, she'd be back to only one plus the two girls that are still living that was involved in this thing. Her husband was supposed to have been arrested for DUI. I don't know if I could sign a bond. Well, I didn't own any property. I said, I don't own any property. I can't sign a bond. And then from there, it kind of went slow motion. I went to the kitchen. A bag of ice was in the kitchen sink, and I went to the kitchen to make a drink. I heard a shot, and it was so close that my ears rang. And then from there, it's slow motion. I turned. There was Beverly there with a pistol in her hand. There was Richard Holcomb saying, no, not now. Well, the first thing I thought of was I knew the kid was in the house because I had brought him, and I knew he was in that bedroom. So my first thinking was, let's get him out of here. So I grabbed him. I remember, and I ran out the house. There was a shared a driveway with the house next door. This guy worked a night shift. He was just coming home. And he saw me. I came out with the kid, and I can remember getting him in the car. I'm trying to start the car. Now, what I'm telling you, I didn't remember that next day. This started coming back years later after the fact. But I can remember that, and I remember I'm trying to cover the kid, crank the car. And these two guys came out. They didn't shoot at me because the guy next door, he would have seen them. But when he went in the house, here they come. And I'm thinking in my mind, if I don't shoot at them, they won't shoot at me and hit the child. And that's the way I was thinking. From there, I got away. I got to my mom and dad's house, which was not far away at all.
When explaining his memory of the shooting, Gary often compares his memory to another event that had happened a few months before. He'd been working at the liquor store in Atlanta when he was robbed at gunpoint.
When this guy pulled a gun on me in Atlanta in 1974, if he walked in this door right now and he looked like he looked at 74, I would recognize him. His photographic memory. I will never, ever forget that face, what he had on. Nothing about it.
That event is clear and distinct in Gary's mind, even if no shots were actually fired. But his memory of Grace being shot and killed, that's different. Gary thinks that he remembers seeing Beverly and Richard Holcomb when the shot first went off, and he's never remembered more than that first shot, that one shot only, so he's always assumed that someone else must have finished off Grace later with four or five shots at a later time, after he'd gotten away. But he does think it was Beverly that fired that first shot.
When I heard the shot, Beverly was standing right in here, right in this area. I'd been to the sink, or headed to the sink, and the shot went off, and that's when everything went crazy. That's when I turned and saw Richard saying, not now, and grabbed the gun and took off.
But what's always seemed kind of interesting to me is that It's not Gary's memories of Beverly with that gun that seem to convince him of Beverly's guilt. He could remember something like that, but it was all so slow and dreamlike. No, what really convinced him of Beverly's guilt, and what made him think that Beverly was the one who killed Grace, was that she confessed and passed a polygraph. So of course she'd done it, right?
Now, I know what Beverly says, that she still thinks I did it, but I don't buy that. Beverly knows what happened in that house at night. I really do believe that. I would like to believe, and I'm hoping you got some new eyes on this thing and different views with it, and you may see something that I've never seen or know something I don't know. And I hope, I would like to think that she didn't, but when she came forward and admitted she had lied, she was brokenhearted about it. I mean, she was really sorry about it at that time when it happened.
Actually, Gary thought that Grace might have been involved too in the murder plot. Or maybe she'd been involved initially, but she changed her mind. Maybe that's why she'd been killed. Or that's why Beverly said that Grace had been trying to protect Gary when she died. I don't trust any of these memories. They sound like nonsense, and from the start, they've always been the guiltiest seeming thing about Gary. They're just these hazy scraps of a dream that have somehow calcified over time, with some parts of the story becoming just a bit more solid every time he tells it. And other parts, they may appear once or twice, but then evaporate again from later retellings. And these memories have a dreamlike logic as well. Gary might say he recalls what happens or remembers something that happens that night, but when you try to break it down, try to get him to pin down in words what these images or thoughts in his head actually look like, there's just nothing there. Like, for example, at one point, in one of the post-conviction proceedings, Gary is asked about two men that he says chased him out into the driveway when he ran out the door with his son. Were they in the house when he arrived? Gary says yes. The two men had been hiding in the back porch, along with Doyle Wade. Okay, but how could he have known they were there? Did he see them? No, Gary said he hadn't, but they had to have been in the house, because they'd chased him out of the house. And they'd had to have been on the back porch, because if they'd been anywhere else in the house, he'd have known they were there. But he hadn't known they were there. So, ergo, those men had been hiding on the back porch when he got home. And also Doyle Wade was hiding back there too, because one of the girls had said Doyle Wade was there that night. Well, okay, sure, that makes a certain kind of sense, but it also makes no sense at all. So, for a little while after I first met Gary, I kept peppering him with questions about his memories, trying to figure out if there was something there worth relying on. And I pretty quickly gave up, because I just wasn't in a place where Gary's memories were any help to me.
But where I'm going with this is, on the night Grace was killed, and I think this is one thing, one reason, they ain't been too worried about what I've been trying to do, because when I've told what I thought I could remember, I don't think any of it's that accurate. Like I told you...
No offense, but I don't either.
You don't?
No.
I don't think she was... I think she was killed before I got there. I think. I don't know. I don't know. I'd like to know. But
do you have any memory of her there at all that night? Can you remember anything you said to her? Anything you talked to her about?
Last time I remember talking to her was at the joint. And what I remember her saying was, the next day was election day. Was going to have to close. She said, let's go ahead and close early. I feel like something bad's going to happen. And I took off. And the best I remember, I went after Sean. And that was the last time I remember talking to her at all. Now, I can remember. Here's the thing is, there were so many nights that those women would park over there at that KO. And you're right. I ain't no way I could have not. I could have got one of those window lights out for going over there. But, I'm thinking, okay, did that happen that night? Or was there so many nights? Did that happen at another time? I'm not sure. I do remember saying that.
And it's also pretty clear that Gary is embarrassed about the way he's explained the shooting in the past. that he hates how it seems to others that his story has changed over time. And he really hates that he told one of these stories on national TV when it was filmed for Inside Edition, when they took him to the house on Maple Street to reconstruct the shooting.
My sister and I both are on here on the TV thing. And we go to the cemetery, looking at the grave, and you got to walk around, and they, you know, what do? You walk around while they're filming you. But we went to the house. Now, in my mind, everything I've told you, I've told the truth. There has been some times when I said I thought it was this way, and I'm in my mind, I'm thinking I remembered that. But then after I said it, man, that ain't right. Truth is, after picking up Sean, I don't remember nothing. I basically remember that. The thing sitting on the porch, if that happened that night, the phone call, I think it happened that night. I think I went to the sink, and I think a gun was shot, and I ran to get Sean. I think that's what happened, but the way I tell it on here is not how I really remember it. And I hate it that I did that on national TV. They got me on there with Nicole Simpson.
For the most part, I've treated all of Gary's memories about what happened at the house that night as a distraction, as meaningless noise, because when it comes to trying to reconstruct what actually went on that night, it just doesn't matter whether it was because Gary was lying or whether he was constructing false memories based on testimony he heard or whether these were fragments of genuine repressed memories that he'd slowly recovered. Because whatever they are, wherever they came from, it just felt like these memories were more likely to lead away from truth and towards it. And even if they're real, or some of them are real, there's no reliable way of sorting between the real ones and the false ones. So how do you know what to follow and what to disregard? And beyond that, Gary's memories could be truly genuine memories and still be completely useless. Because Gary might be recalling his events because they happened, but not on that night.
I've told you before, I have no idea how much your memory to trust. And I've asked you, is it possible everything you recall is either another night, like the stuff about the shooting, the KO? At one point I asked you, is it possible you never even went home?
It's possible.
And then there's another possibility, too, that his memory is real, more or less, and that he did exactly what he says he did that night, that he heard a gunshot, and then he turned and ran away.
One thing that's bothered me, and I'm thinking, could this be why it got blocked out? Grace stood beside me more than once, and we really came close to a gun battle several times. Well, the reason I told you those stories a while ago, if I was there and Grace was being shot at or she was facing danger, I would never have ran away from it, I don't think. And that's one thing that's bothered me is, did I run and get out of there with something happening to her? And I don't think I did. I don't think I would have done that. But I don't know, and that has tormented the hell out of me.
At the same time that Gary's memories began to return, Beverly's own stories began to change as well, and significantly. There had always been inconsistencies in what she said. From the time of her mother's murder until Gary's release from prison, Beverly gave nearly 24 statements in all, either in written affidavits or court testimony or in oral statements to investigators. And there's just a sea of contradictions. Sometimes she claims that she'd been pressured by Sheriff Garner or Gary's family or her own family. Sometimes she's adamant that everyone had been clear to her. They only want her to tell the truth. For God's sake, just tell the truth. And sometimes she says that Bo Salmon's friend Richard Holcomb is the one that had the gun that killed her mother. And sometimes she says that the gun had been buried with Mama in the casket. And sometimes she really did see a shadow that night, and sometimes she really did not. But as confusing as all these stories are, none are as baffling as the one she made in September 1976, while in prison for writing bad checks. The one where she confessed to Grace's murder. Even the reasons she claims she did it doesn't make any sense. In that letter to the correctional officer that Beverly had written, she says, "On the 13th day of August 1974, I shot and killed my mother for the exact reason that I was jealous of them living together. I shot her and walked off and got back into bed." But jealous of who living together? She never explains that, and no one ever really presses her to explain. The closest we get is from the polygraph examiner who talked to Beverly both before and after she passed the polygraph, claiming she'd killed her mother. And the examiner said that, yes, she told him she very much wanted to take the examination. That she'd been trying to tell people that she'd killed her mother, but no one listened to her. And according to the examiner, Beverly stated to me that she and her mother had been on the front porch of their home, and her mother was scolding her for being out with her boyfriend just for the purpose of having sex. She was upset about it, and after this, her mother left the front porch and went into the kitchen. She, in turn, went into the living room to talk with her sister. She said that she remembered that her mother kept her revolver in the bedroom on the shelf in the closet, and she went in and got it and went into the kitchen and shot her mother, and that she did not remember anything after that. There's another odd detail of Beverly's confession, too. One that she told to Lieutenant Jerry Schaefer and John Barnett after she was asked where the gun had gone. What had happened to it after she'd shot her mother? Beverly told them that she'd thrown the gun out the back door and that it was picked up by a person in a white Cadillac, and that the driver of the white Cadillac had been Richard Holcomb. But even though at first it seemed so confusing and so hard to make sense of, I now think that out of all of the stories Beverly has told, her confession is the easiest to understand. When I asked Beverly why she confessed, her answer was simple. "I was very good at I done it," she said. "I'd done anything to keep anyone from getting a whooping. I didn't do the dishes, I didn't sweep the floor, or I did break the dishes, I did steal those items from the store. I didn't want my sisters to take any blame." I asked her if Charlotte had ever returned the favor, and Beverly said, "No, she always blamed me." There's another reason, too, that Beverly has given for why she confessed. She told Gary in one of her phone calls to him that her husband had made her confess. And at first, I dismissed it as nonsense, one of Beverly's stories that sound like drama, not truth. But then I looked closer into it, and I realized that this might actually explain it all.
"Michael Minshew made me do that. Michael Minshew said I killed my daddy and I got out in 6 months."
This makes perfect sense to me. When Michael Minshew was a child, 11 or 12, his father had been shot and killed, and when police arrived, they were told that Michael's father had been assaulting his mother, and acting in her defense, Michael grabbed a shotgun and killed him. Ultimately, the grand jury declined to indict him, likely due to his age, and he was released. So yeah, that does make sense to me, that Michael Minshew might have told her that if she wanted to make this all go away, make the whole mess just disappear, just confess to it. Say you did it. You were a child, you won't get in trouble. If you say you did it, that'll be the end of it. So she did. She confessed. Gary tried to use it as part of another post-conviction proceeding, but that didn't work. The court was exasperated and confused by Beverly's claims, but it wasn't going to indulge that kind of nonsense. So Gary remained in prison. And even if Beverly's confession didn't end up helping Gary any, it's something she's had to live with ever since. Gary's last post-conviction proceeding ended in November 1977. He was out of options at that point. Nothing else he could do could really get a sentence overturned or change the outcome. Still, his life on the whole was improving. As much as it can improve when you're serving a life sentence for murder and every appeal or post-conviction proceeding you've done has been denied. But, hey, he could go home sometimes.
"I was a statewide trustee. And I'd made statewide trustee when I got to Carroll County. statewide trustee, then I could go home certain times of the year for a 3-day pass. You could choose Thanksgiving or Christmas or whatever. And a family member had to come get me. Family member had to take me back. And I still have my driver's license. They had not expired yet. And the state patrol barracks was right next door to the prison camp. So I walk up there one day and get my driver's license renewed.
Finally, Gary ends up at Floyd County Jail full time. He left Carroll County and was relocated back to the Floyd County Jail. This wasn't just to be closer to family. Gary had a plan, and getting sent back to Floyd County, where he could work in public buildings, was part of it. And at the same time, Gary was carrying out his parole campaign. He was trying to get parole by having people who supported him write letters, offer employment, convince the parole board he should be released. Something else happened in his case in the meantime, though.
So the county police would be the one who would take me back to the prison at night after I got through. Well, there was a police officer named Jerry Boyd. He came to me one day. He said, man, I've been talking to the GBI. They've got a witness that says you were not in that house when she was actually killed.
Who this informant was and what they told the GBI, that seems like it could be a big deal. But Gary never learned more about it. He continued working towards parole, which seemed to be working. Or at least making progress, despite the fact that he'd made enemies with the warden at the Floyd County Jail. Gary had made suggestions about how the Department of Corrections could restructure its procurement department and to run it in a way that was more efficient, which had accidentally caused the Floyd County Jail warden to lose some administrative power. So the warden wasn't Gary's biggest fan.
But the warden called me in one evening. I got back down there one evening, and he said, he called me in his office. He said, you know you ain't gonna make parole. He said, you're going to be with me a long time, and you might as well get used to that. Again, all I can do is, yeah, yes, sir, thank you. I already knew I made parole. I knew I was going to make it.
Oh.
I found out I made parole before the warden found out I made parole, because the purchasing agent was on the phone every day with the parole board. They were all rooting for me. This purchasing agent on the phone, I was walking by one day and he grabbed me. He said, can you hear me? Man, what happened? What have I done? There's a big walk-in safe. He pushed me in there and he said, you've made it.
And as for that GBI informant that Officer Jerry Boyd had told him about, well, nothing ever came of that.
Jerry Boyd was trying to get something together to get the GBI to, meet with me and, maybe try to get something going. I'm also coming up for parole at this time. Well, I didn't hear anything else from it. And I made parole.
Once out of prison, Gary spent the next 9 years getting his sentence commuted and then received an administrative pardon. Life on the outside wasn't always easy after 7 years behind bars, but he did have some success.
So I made parole and I went to work at an office supply place. Now, you know, there's a lot of difference in working with office supplies than selling beer and wine and liquor, and, you know, big difference. So I had to learn it pretty quick. And they wasn't doing much business in office furniture at that time. And I've got a reason for telling you this, because this is a great story. He put me in charge of the buying the office furniture. Well, Han down here, we'd buy one or two file cabinets, one or two desks. And I got to looking at this stuff, and I said, hey, they got this surplus stuff. You know, might have a scratch or a dent or something like that. We could buy that 10 cents on the dollar. We could sell that 50% off and still gross 25-30% profit margin. And got interested in that. Well, guess what? They built a new county jail. Well, my old buddy, the purchasing agent, he called me one day, and he said, hey, man, they're going to furnish that thing, and said, we want y'all to bid on it. I go up there and I get the bid. We went in and me and my buddy, the owner, it was a pride thing. We didn't make much money on it, but we got that bid. Mm-hmm. I made that sale, $50,000 sale for the jail. And guess what? They didn't open on time. Well, I got this furniture coming in from all over the country. this is sweet revenge. So I tell the person, I said, look, we ain't making much money on this thing. You guys could help foot the bill to store this stuff. We'll leave it on the trailers, but we need it in a safe place. I said, how about down at the chain gang camp? Here I go in a company car, and I got a convoy of tractor and trailers following me. I go in. Mr. Warden, I need you to guard this firm. Oh, man, he was mad.
Gary made it out of prison, and even if he still had the conviction for Grace's murder hanging over his head, he was able to start a new life on the outside, this time with a career in office supplies rather than bootlegging. But as impressive as Gary's successful campaign was to obtain parole, something about it seemed off. Rabia and I had the same reaction to that part of Gary's story. Sure, he won over a lot of community support and built up a favorable paper record to impress the parole board. But still, how the hell did he get paroled 7 years into a life sentence while still adamantly declaring that he was innocent in the murder he was convicted of? Seriously? That seems a little bit not normal.
The fact that you could even apply for parole in 7 years into a life sentence is what I'm... Was that, like, normal?
It was a law that you come up for parole in 7 years.
Really?
For making it?
Yeah, you could. It was a law. You
but
could,
actually making it. That's what happened there.
As a rule, you didn't make it for 15 years or longer, or in some cases, never. But I had a lot of people that believed in me and a lot of people who were sending these letters. And
maybe that's all it was. A lot of people who believed in him and a lot of people who sent in letters. But while parole was a step along the way, that wasn't the end of it. Gary wanted to clear his name. He wanted answers. He wanted to know who'd killed Grace. And he wasn't alone in that.
I remember going to police station, and I remember talking to Kim Tynes, and I cannot tell you anything else. I don't remember. And I've tried to remember. I've asked God to let me see, let me remember, and I don't know if he don't want me to or if it just don't happen that way, you know?
Well,
maybe God don't want to put more on me than I can bear. He says he won't. But God knows I've bared this ever since she died.
Well, it could end as soon as we
investigate a little bit.
Yeah, and it would come off of you.
I know I didn't hurt my mama. I know I didn't take my mama's life. And I know you know that too. And I know all you got to stand on is that piece of paper. And I don't blame you, Gary. And I don't blame you anymore, but I'm telling you, I want to find out as bad as you do.
Thanks for listening to episode 3 of Undisclosed, the State vs. Gary Mitchum Reeves. Don't forget to go to our website to check out the episode transcripts, case materials, photos, and more. If you have any information about the people or cases discussed on the show, I'd love to talk to you. Please reach out via email at undisclosedpodcast@gmail.com or through social media. And if you'd like to discuss the show, please join us at Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or Reddit. Big thanks to our jack-of-all-trades producer, Mithil Telhan, and Nadja Bhatti, whose assistance has been invaluable. Our sound editor is Rebecca Lavoie of the Crime Writers On podcast. If you haven't listened, go check it out now. And if you found the episode transcripts useful, big thanks go out to our volunteers who put the transcript together, at Slow Dawning, at Beeves, at The Wind and Rain, and at Old Single Bitter. Until next time...